Well, first, I would like to thank the organizers for organizing this whole thing and say that I'm quite pleased to be here. It's my first time at the Perimeter Institute, and it's very nice. So my talk is going to be on anisotropic conformal infinity. And as Peter mentioned, we're having a bit of a slight change of tact here. And in particular, I'm interested in trying to apply some of the ideas that have come out in the course of constructing anisotropic gravity models to perhaps put it in a more general framework where it can even be applied to models that actually do have Lorentz invariants, but have some other feature that wants to induce an anisotropic structure in the theory. All right. So, infinity. Now, infinity, what is it good for? Well, the concept of conformal infinity is important for a variety, used for a variety of things in general relativity, for trying to make sensible specifications of your boundary conditions on your various fields, for properly defining things like horizons. In other words, analyzing the complete causal structures of the space-time, defining asymptotic charges. It's important in ADS-CFT correspondence simply for specifying the problem, specifying the geometry on which your dual conformal field theory is supposed to live, etc. Let's just look a little bit at infinity and general relativity. So typically, we define infinity using a definition that's due to Penrose and other people, in which we take a manifold, we take our spacetime, and we conformally embed it into some larger spacetime. And there are various conditions we impose upon this, but the essential point is that we use the concept, we use Weyl transformations on the metric in order to remove the infinite components of the metric and induce a sensible metric on the boundary of the space. This prescription is consistent, that is to say, and here what I mean is it's invariant under coordinate transformations because diffeomorphisms preserve the group of Weyl transformations. Weyl transformations are a normal subgroup of the direct of the semi-direct product of diffeomorphisms with Weyl transformations. And it's also useful because it preserves causal structure, and therefore, as I mentioned before, it can be used to analyze causal structures of the global causal structures. Right, yes. So delta x is an infinitesimal diffeomorphism generator, and omega is an infinitesimal Weyl transformation. And of course, there are finite versions of this as well. All right, so we can try to ask similar questions about Hodrava-Lipschitz gravity. So there are a number of differences from the usual situation. One is that when you take a Foeschian structure and you use it to introduce higher spatial derivatives, you end up with a causal structure that's degenerate, in the sense that the light cone in a relativistic theory gets flattened. And this means that the particular property of Weyl transformations I mentioned before, that they preserve causal properties, is no longer important. That's a more restrictive assumption than we need in this case. Also, these theories, of course, as has been reiterated about 150 times during this conference, we have a smaller symmetry group in these theories. And that means that you're certainly going to have weaker consistency conditions on what you're allowed, on what sorts of rescalings of metric components are allowed. And finally, of course, we have some kind of anisotropy in the way that that spatial and temporal components of the metric behave. And that means that there's no particular reason a priori to scale them in the same way. It's much more natural to have an anisotropic concept of what you mean by conformal infinity in these states. Now, there are also other motivations for considering anisotropic aspects. And one of those motivations comes from recent ideas that appear in the concept of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Now, let me just do a very quick review of ADS-CFT correspondence. So the basic idea is that you have is that there are various reasons for expecting quantum gravity to be holographic. So very generally, very vaguely speaking, the quantum gravity in some region of space-time is supposed to somehow be captured by behavior on the boundary of that region of space. Okay, that's very vague. You can make a slightly more specific statement in situations motivated by string theory. So in ADS-like spaces, you have the possibility of ADS-CFT correspondence. In this case, what you make the much more specific conjecture that the partition function for... So first of all, there's one thing you should know. That is that in ADS-like spaces, the partition function for quantum gravity is a functional of the boundary conditions that you impose for fields at infinity. And so the statement in the ADS-CFT correspondence is that this partition function for gravity is actually the generating functional for some field theory that's supposed to be living on the boundary of that space. And the reason it's a conformal field theory is just that the particular properties of the bulk geometry are such that you have scale invariants and conformal transformations allowed arising from isometries. Oh, that would be helpful. Yes, the hockey stick. Isometries of the bulk geometry translate precisely when you project them onto the boundary into conformal transformations. Okay. But recently, people have started to look at asymptotically anisotropic space. So this is space-times which don't have isotropic behavior of the different coordinates as you try to go to infinity. And this has largely been motivated, although it's not the only situation which just has appeared. It's largely been motivated by interest in trying to develop ADS-CFT-like duals to condensed matter systems. Now, so some of these include trying to look at properties like superconduction systems like cold atoms, fermions of unitarity, trying to look at Lipschitz-like thick points, and try to figure out something about try to have some idea of how strongly coupled condensed matter type systems might behave. These systems typically, though not always, they have anisotropic scaling exponents. The behavior, so that means that they have some sort of scale invariance, but the scale invariance, of course, does not act the same way in the spatial directions as in the time directions. And, of course, there are generalizations of that to spatial anisotropy. I'm going to stick to the case of anisotropy between space and time. So you have this expression. Let me stick again. You have this expression, which we've all seen many times. And so in the context of ADS-CFT duals, there is a very natural way of trying to translate this into a geometric state. So in ADS-CFT, the scale invariance is induced from a bulk isometry. And in the same way, you can write down very simple-looking metrics in which the scaling anisotropy between space and time can be precisely compensated for by an anisotropy in the falloff conditions of metric components at infinity. Yes.
Anisotropy if you're at the boundary, so when the R component, when you go to infinity?
So you only have the anisotropy, you only have anisotropy on the boundary. So it's really some property of the boundary, whatever that means. This is what I'm trying to address. Now, what are you asking about the R components?
R to infinity, okay. Right, the extra, And then
on the bulk,
everything is isotropic.
I mean, it's isotropic in the sense that the usual embeddings that people propose for these theories are in theories which actually have local Lorentz symmetry, but you're simply breaking some, but you don't have some global Lorentz symmetry that acts on the space time as a whole, or acts on the bulk.
If I can comment briefly. There's a hierarchy of structures that you can look into. Here you have only a metric. You haven't said what kind of theory this solves. And you can be conservative and say, let's assume that the bulk theory is just dimensional GR, perhaps with some matter. That's the typical perspective that people have been taking. And that's also the perspective to which our construction applies. Or you can be more adventurous and say, perhaps this even solves some anisotropic theory of gravity in the bulk. But we can take for now the more conservative approach and say you're not changing the rules in the bulk. They're just convention GR.
Absolutely. So this construction is certainly fairly easy to apply in the case of anisotropic gravity theory. But the interesting thing is you can also apply it to the case of anisotropic gravity.
So are there natural solutions of anisotropic gravity theory which look like this?
We've looked into this a little bit. Of course, one immediate problem that you end up with is this component here. So the most natural way of embedding this would be to give the last variable spatial dependence. And there have been various issues. People have been addressing this, of course, a lot of the conferences. So it's not something that we've looked into in great detail. But of course, what people have primarily been considering has been isotropic gravity, embedding in isotropic gravity. All right. So there is a problem that is with defining the boundary geometry, and that is the Penrose boundary is degenerate. So if we switch to a coordinate system in which the way we get a finite boundary metric is clear, we see that we want to rescale the metric. The natural way to rescale the metric is by power of r squared. So we end up with a degenerate boundary. Now. There are various problems with this. One of them is that this is supposed to be dual to a theory that lives on some positive number of spatial dimensions. So in particular, if you write down, for instance, the action for a scalar function, you can look at the behavior at infinity, and there's absolutely no problem with allowing the scalar function to have non-trivial dependence on the x coordinates at large distances. So that means that we're missing something in this picture. There are geometric properties of the boundary which Penrose's definition simply doesn't give us. So we really have a dysentopia of Lucian space from the point of view of a boundary of a boundary field.
Okay. Can you give an example of which is the Dirac construction whose near horizon gives you this anisotropic
diagram? A Dirac construction. So currently, well, I think that even Alex Maloney was going to do some discussions of this. So at the moment, this particular metric doesn't have, to the best of my knowledge, any proper embeddings into string theory. Now, you can go ahead and write down effective field theories. Like you can Einstein prototype theory in which a vector field takes on an expectation value that supports the anisotropy of the metric at infinity. But there are various things you can do.
Because of a serious, say, conceptual problem, or because simply nobody really was looking at it.
Many people have been looking at it, and nobody found an embedding.
Right. So there are various papers labeled no-go theorem, which aren't really no-go theorems. But okay. No-go theorems given the strict assumptions.
But in the Schrodinger case, you get it from null norms.
That's right. That's right. So you can do. So there are other types of models where you really can construct what seems to be a proper embedding in string theory. Although there are also some issues with those geometries. I don't think I'll go into that here. Okay. From given this context, it's clear that we need some way to define infinity, which is really compatible with a concept of geometric anisotropy. We need to be able to deal with the anisotropy in the geometry as we approach the boundary. The most conservative approach is just to try to modify the usual Penrose definition in a sort of minimal way. And so the simplest thing to try is to try to modify your concept of Weyl transformation, to make your Weyl transformation consistent with anisotropy. So there are a couple of issues with this. The first is that Weyl transformations, of course, need to close with your diffeomorphism symmetries. Otherwise, you're not going to get some invariant concept of boundary geometry. And so given that we're talking about anisotropy, it's natural to look to anisotropic gravity models for inspiration in how to deal with this problem. So here's some expressions that we all know very well. Oh, you have a question?
It would help me, can you just make a plain statement about where you're going? I mean, I know Penrose's stuff very well, so in the end, is there going to be a conformal completion which is a geometry where there's a well-defined geometry of the boundary, and what is that?
Yes, that's the point.
Okay, so you are you are using the standard Penrose procedure?
A modification of the standard Penrose procedure. It's not the straightforward standard Penrose procedure, because of course you apply it and it doesn't give you something useful. So you need to make some modification. So the point of this is to look at the modification and then look at some of the implications of the modifications.
Let me ask you, what do you mean by closed with the diffeomorphism? Because Weyl transformations are not diffeomorphisms; they don't take you between diffeomorphisms.
What I mean is that the diffeomorphism group has an action on the Weyl transformations, and the Weyl the group of Weyl transformations is preserved under that action of the diffeomorphism. Right. So
I have two manifolds: the infinite manifold and the compact manifold, and there's a map between them, which is a Weyl transformation,
right.
And this has diffeomorphisms, and this has diffeomorphisms.
Mm-hmm.
So you mean that this times this diffeomorphism is the same thing as making some diffeomorphism here and then going here?
So if you're going to have
The idea is that you don't want the concept of infinity to be coordinate dependent.
Right.
And so if you perform a diffeomorphism first and then you apply a Weyl transformation, you want to end up with the same concept of infinity as before.
So you want for every diffeomorphism on the original manifold and every Weyl transformation, there corresponds a diffeomorphism on the compact manifold that closes that diagram.
We know that the Penrose definition already works in the isotropic case, so we're not inventing anything new in the isotropic case. We know what the rules are. We're just saying it doesn't work for an isotropic.
I understand. I'm just trying to understand. I'm just trying to get the picture in the head of the two manifolds,
okay,
and the two different morphism groups.
Okay.
And the map between them.
Okay.
So it's just a question. It's a question of finding a version of that which is compatible with, when you're done, the theory, which is the boundary of the compact, the geometry, which is the boundary of the compact manifold, is not Minkowski space-time, but some other space-time.
That's right. Okay. So one of the most basic concepts that we've encountered in the process of looking at anisotropic gravity models is the concept of foliation. I won't go over this in detail, but I'm going to be paying attention to manifolds where you have foliation by spatial slices. You perform the ADM decomposition with respect to this foliation. And then diffeomorphisms,
infinitesimal generators, which preserve this foliation, have simple transformation properties on the components of the ADM decomposition. And given this, there's a simple way to define a different version of Weyl transformations, which is consistent with this restricted group of diffeomorphisms. So, again, given the ADM type decomposition, and assuming that we have a foliation, we can scale the spatial part of the metric, and the shift variables as usual, and the lattice variable is given some sort of arbitrary scaling exponent z. And this definition is properly closed under all available diffeomorphisms. That is, it's a coordinate invariant concept within coordinates respecting the foliation. Okay. So how do we use this to define an anisotropic conformal infinity? Well, if a manifold already has a foliated structure, so for instance, if we're working with a theory of gravity that has a built-in foliation structure, then we don't have any problems. It boils down just to identifying what choice of scaling exponent we want to use, etc. Of course, in the case of general relativity, we do have a problem in that this procedure is not coordinate invariant is not coordinating bearing in the bulk. That is to say, if you include space dependent time translations, then you're going to end up with a disagreement in the scaling exponents between components before and after the application. Okay, but we do want to be able to apply this to relativistic field theories, as Evisa suggested by these ADS-CFT rules to condensed matter models. What do we do? Well, the thing we have to remember is that we're interested in anisotropic infinity. And that means that any prescription we make, it doesn't have to be defined deep in the bulk, provided it gives you a sensible concept at infinity. So whatever we do only has to be able to find near infinity. If we want to apply this concept, then we need to have some sense, specific sense, in which the space in which the bulk geometry is, therefore has a foliation that exists at infinity. And in fact, the way this arises in GR is that when you consider the diffeomorphisms that actually preserve your phase space, there is a natural foliation structure that's induced at infinity. So I'm just going to give a few examples of how this works in the naive way.
That's
it.
So basically, that's the fundamental thing. And then if you go to the bulk, then basically there's some isotropic GR immersion.
Mm-hmm. That's it. So in other words, you do have to put
some additional geometric structure on your manifold. In addition, just to declaring the topology, you also have to declare that the boundary that lies in the conformal embedding, actually does have is foliated by some slices and has a foliation. And there's no problem with that. That's a geometric fundamental. What I just mean is
diffeomorphisms are preserved.
But are you implying that there are fixed foliation? Because that's how I read that sentence is used.
Mm-hmm.
It uses the foliation at infinity, so that
in other words, the diffeomorphisms are precisely such. The diffeomorphisms that survive are precisely such that they preserve a foliation. At least in an asymptotic sense.
But they're not unique. There could be different foliations that survive. Right?
But what do you mean?
I mean, they could have different foliations at infinity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's correct. Sure. They're different. That's, yeah.
It could be different choices of boundary conditions. In ADS-CFT, the way this usually works is the opposite direction, where people specify follow-up conditions on everything, and they say this is the phase space conjecture. And then you look at it more carefully and see that these follow-up conditions are preserved. Not by all diffeomorphisms near the boundary, but foliation preserving diffeomorphisms near the boundary.
Sure.
That's what it means.
Okay. Okay. So let's just go ahead and naively apply the procedure to Lipschitz
space. So Lipschitz space, if we just decompose it in the ADM decomposition, then we have the following variables. And so as long as we assign critical exponent z equal to 2, then when we apply the rescaling procedure using anisotropic Weyl transformations, we end up with a rescaled metric, which gives a sensible boundary metric that's going to properly reflect the concept of boundary geometry.
Penrose's case where it was readjusted a lot.
The boundary is a codimension one, and you now have something with respect to which you can measure, for instance, distances between points where you want to be able to have correlation.
No, I'm just a little bit surprised. If I have a space and I take a subspace, right? Mm-hmm. This is what the boundary is, right? Something at infinity, it's a subspace, a slice. How can it be that the slice has different isotropy than the normal space.
So as far as the geometry is concerned, all you need to do, so you can simply impose as a geometric concept that you have some slice in your space that has some foliation. There's nothing inconsistent about it.
So the induced metric are those infinities as anisotropic. And somehow you can get rid of this.
So in particular what you would have is from the so you may have some foliation of your boundary. You may have some foliation of your boundary by spatial size. And then you may have some bulk, and then this is contained in some larger geometry. And there are, of course, all sorts of different ways that you can continue the foliation into the bulk, right? And these different ways are going to be commuted by the allowed diffeomorphisms. But the only thing that's important is the equivalence class that these induce up here. So as long as you're just considering the equivalence class, then you're fine. And the way it works out is that the symmetries, the things that preserve the phase space, are precisely such that this equivalence class is low. And I think that's a fairly straightforward state of the concept. Is that
it? Yeah,
okay. Another question?
I understand that you are breaking Lorentzian norms here. But the original point of doing Wallace transformation is because it preserves constant structure.
Right.
Now this transformation certainly doesn't preserve that.
Right. That's actually required. It's absolutely required because look at these boundary theories. They're supposed to be theories that are like coupled versions of theories of Lipschitz. So you're going to have your boundary action is going to want to have generically terms like this. You have a degenerate causal structure in exactly the same way. So it's no surprise that the Penrose definition gives you a degenerate boundary. The Penrose definition precisely tells you what the causal structure is.
Right.
So it identifies all things which have the same causal past and causal future. Oh, same causal past. So that actually works out perfectly well. This still preserves the causal structure of the boundary.
Your transformation.
My transformations preserve the causal structure of the boundary.
Because in the boundary, the light cones open up, so you have a
non-randastic
structure of the boundary.
Yeah.
That's preserved by these steps.
So as you go into the boundary, you end up with... Mm-hmm. It opens up, and as a result, you can rescale the lapse variable, and it doesn't cause any problems. So that seems to be right, and that's an important feature. It needs to be right. Yes.
So is the statement at the end that the PMS proof goes over to just a one-dimensional parameterization of the boundary? Is that the statement that the boundary is S2 cross R with a reparameterization variance on the R rather than the whole BMS group?
Sorry, I didn't...
So the BMS, usually what... The BMS group is the symmetry of the boundary of Minkowski space,
prime minus
with the point of spatial infinity. So the BMS group includes arbitrary Lorentz transformations as they act in infinity, which is to say it's an arbitrary local.
If I can answer this question, here it's exactly the same as in ADS CFT, namely the bulk, the asymptotic bulk isometries, whatever they end up being, induce a non-relativistic conformal structure. So the analog of the BMS group here is precisely the non-relativistic conformal symmetry group on the boundary.
Right. So the symmetry group is rotations in the Euclidean group plus the conformal.
This
case, okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's
right.
Yeah.
That's all. That's all it means in this particular case. There are cases where more remains, but
right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry, I didn't catch your meaning. Okay. So, speaking of other cases, it turns out that the precise definition of rescaling that I gave you is not one that is sufficient for all cases of interest. So I'll get into that in just a moment. So the particular, the unsatisfactory results appear in situations that are fairly familiar, such as warped ADS3, such as appears in at least as a perturbative ground state of topologically massive gravity, and in Schrodinger spacetimes, that is the spacetimes that are supposed to be give you some kind of ADS CFT type rules to fermions of Viterbi. So in approaching these general problems, we have learned a lesson that modifying Weyl transformations it generally requires altering the diffeomorphism. Now, so far, all we've done as far as altering it is made it small. But we can also do something slightly more radical. And that is, let's actually modify how diffeomorphisms act on metric components. Now, this actually is motivated. But let me start just by describing how this works. So in the simplest case, you can consider two-dimensional space-time, and you have a foliation by spatial slices, as usual. But now, instead of having foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms act in the usual way, for foliation-preserving diffeomorphism in this form, we postulate the following metric variation. So what's missing here is XX contributions of the metric here, TX contributions of the metric here. Okay.
Exotic. This is a particular non-relativistic contraction of the
moon. Yeah, it happens in the next slide. No, that's not. Okay, yeah, right here. So these rules are simply
exactly what you get after you do a particular contraction of the action of diffeomorphism group on metric. Particularly contraction, non-relativistic contraction of the diffeomorphism group, and you examine how it acts. So it has a simple way of deriving them, which is completely analogous to how foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms originally characterized. Okay, now we postulate different anisotropic scaling. We don't work with lattice variables and shift variables. We just work directly with these metric components. And these have the property that they actually do close with the metric transformations on the previous slide. So this is some sort of non-relativistic, peculiar non-relativistic metric structure, which is consistent with an even further modified form of anisotropic biotransformations. So where can we apply this? Well, one place is in warped ADS3. So here's the metric for global warped ADS3. And in particular, if you look at it, you see that this U variable has a characteristic scaling with R as 2, and this V variable has a characteristic scaling of 0. And so again, the Penrose boundary is going to be degenerate. You can't remove this problem by first coordinate system. This space has a particular collection of asymptotic isometries. And what I'm interested really in identifying here is the leading contribution to the diffeomorphism, the highest order contributions to the diffeomorphism group. Now, these have the following property, that they are asymptotically foliation preserving. So in other words, if you ignore the lower order pieces, then this f function is a function only of u. This g function, in this particular case, is not a function of v. It is a function of u, though. It is asymptotically foliation preserving. And everything else has subleading corrections. Note that you have a 1 over r squared here versus a 1 over r here. That actually is important, too, although I'm not going to go into it in detail. Now, these diffeomorphism, this collection of vectors which preserve the phase space, they're consistent with the following assignment of anisotropic conformal weights. So in other words, we rescale by 2, 1, and 0, just as in the slide I had a few slides ago. And using these weights, one finds that one just runs a process and you get a metric at anisotropic infinity of the following form. And so this metric is, it's a perfectly happy boundary geometry, albeit with a somewhat peculiar, fundamentally speaking, with a somewhat peculiar behavior under diffeomorphisms. We can apply similar considerations to Schrodinger space. So this is the space that's supposed to give us some kind of dual to fermions of unitarity. It's characterized by having, in addition to scaling invariance, So it has, as its isometries, it has things which induce conformal transformations, non-relativistic conformal transformations in the boundary, the rescalings, there are some special conformal transformations in Galilean transformations.
What is fermion of unitarity?
It's a condensed matter CFT that has this type of conformal invariance. It's supposed to be the universal theory with a U of one symmetry that has the full Schrodinger conformal as symmetries.
Okay.
It's a story which is orthogonal to this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's just a problem. Yeah. We can point you in the direction of the papers where this is discussed. Yeah. No, there's no reason to go into it in detail.
I have a very naive question.
Yes.
When people do this kind of ADS, Lifshitz symmetry, CFT calculations, they just do the naive thing of taking a cutoff boundary, you know, calculating solutions of wave equations and again, just plugging things in and then stripping off some powers of, you know, of the cutoff. So I guess what you're going to do is this going to be, it provides in some sense justification for that procedure?
Absolutely. That's really, that was one of the big motivations.
And I was always wondering why do people do that?
So the
other comment is that in view of a cutoff boundary, it almost, if we just naively cut off at some value of r equal to r naught, it looks like it leads to something where the speed of light is infinite.
In
the limit, right? When r, speed of light is some r naught, or proportional to the cutoff or something like that. So this thing sort of reflects that, but you sort of done an isotropic thing to take that off, you know.
Exactly. So this is really the motive. One big motivation for doing this. The process you're mentioning is the process of holographic renormalization, where you can't simply evaluate the semi-classical approximation to the quantum gravity partition function. You need to provide some cutoff. You need to cut off at some finite distance. And there actually are problems associated with doing this properly under the usual view. People have had difficulty running the holographic renormalization program. And it turns out that the reason is precisely because the counter terms you have to subtract off actually violate. They're not generically covariant. And there's no reason for them to be, because the only symmetries you need to worry about are the diffeomorphism symmetries preserving the faces. So this is all intimately connected with that, and it's what's necessary in order to get a sensible, for instance, stress energy tensor.
There are examples in the literature though where papers by myself, for example, were worked out carefully in the form of the counter terms. Indeed, they're not point grade, right?
Because it's not a symmetry at the back, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, so this has been carried out.
It has been seen in particular examples, and we are providing a systematics kind of behind the scenes, why it works and how to do it in the world.
There are also additional reasons for doing this. So you want to be able, you also want to be able to understand the properties of the boundary geometry, in particular, to allow more general boundary geometries. There's no reason why you can't, in principle, why you can't put these CFTs on a curved space-time, I think that it is important to have a procedure which really firmly identifies the geometric issues, rather than rather than rather than doing a case by case.
I wanted to comment briefly on Schumit's question because I noticed that our compact notation might be somewhat misleading. The conformal metric on the boundary, the bottom line here, it may have been written in a seemingly relativistic form here, but that's just a shorthand. It actually does have a completely non-relativistic structure with the speed of light being infinite. So if you look at the conformal transformations, they do represent the conformal transformations of a non-relativistic theory.
Right. So you really do need to break. It's not kosher to put these metric components together in the usual relativistic way. Just like when you're writing down these general, when you're writing down Lipschitz theory, you don't use the usual metric components for defining the kinetic terms. You have the last variables appearing in appropriate ways. Okay. All right. Another general sort of example where similar structure appears is in Near Horizon Extreme Kerr. So this has Near Horizon Extreme Kerr. So the Near Horizon limit of the Extreme Kerr black hole, you have a metric of this form. You have omega and lambda are some functions of this of the state variable. Now a variety of people have studied this. I've studied Near Horizon Extreme Kerr and looked at the possibility of some sort of CFT dual and tried to use the use some sort of Virchow algebra to try to extract entropy computations, a prediction of the entropy. Okay, so the general proposal is that it's supposed to be described as a CFT dual. One feature I just thought I'd mention is that this is a geometry with some sort of anisotropic conditions at infinity, which is actually supported by the Einstein-Hilbert action. This is anisotropic just because, again, you have this phi variable, and it's appearing with a distinctly different scaling from the t variable. So once again, the Penrose boundary is going to be singular. So in particular, in order to get some kind of geometry in the theta direction, sorry, in the phi direction, we clearly need to assign a scaling dimension of zero to the phi phi component of the metric, the cultural dimension. In particular, this makes me uncomfortable about the usual claims that these are dual to a 2D CFT, at least in the usual sense. And the reason for that is precisely that the metric, the geometry that the metric spits out, simply is not some sort of standard relativistic geometry on the boundary. In particular, the things which are supposed to induce the scale transformations would be correspond to rescalings of the U variable. And the appearance of U in different powers means that the action of rescaling on these theories can't act as a topic. Now there are various exotic possibilities like a formulation of a 2D CFT. Where you have Virchow generators that act non-locally or something, but in any event, there's definitely something that needs to be cleared up here.
In one copy.
Right. So there's only one copy of the Virchow algebra that's realized with finite charges.
Maybe the anti-chiral part is scaled away in some way.
Right. The type of structure that appears, I'll talk about this a little more in a moment. The type of structure that appears in work made yet, where people have also discussed some sort of chiral features. The behavior that those things have, it really looks an awful lot like you start with two Virchow-Soros, and then you take some kind of non-relativistic limit in which this Virchow-Soro degenerates into a U1 Katsumudi algebra. So it really looks like some sort of non-relativistic structure.
Okay. Let me just mention the concept of anisotropic conformal equivalence, so that we can talk systematically about anisotropic conformal max. So as soon as we have a concept of conformal, a different concept of conformal transformations, we also are going to be handed with a different concept of anisotropic conformal equivalence classes of metrics, where metrics are equivalent if they're related by an anisotropic Weyl scale. And so we also have, of course, a concept of anisotropic conformal metrics. That is, foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms that preserve the anisotropic conformal equivalence. Yes?
My box and my boundary, let's say I'm in equilibrium with some fluid or whatever, I have this photographic principle, right? If I change something here, I change something in the box, right? I can map this. So you're now defining this mapping such that there will not be any anisotropy. I mean, if I'm changing something here, I could say, do I maybe then generate some anisotropy in the bulk? Is it so clear that things like that cannot happen? Or you're choosing a mapping such that things like that can happen?
Well, I guess it's...
The short answer would be that in the relativistic ABS CFT, there's a well-established correspondence, a holographic correspondence between correlation functions on both sides. And we're just trying to make that more precise in cases where the boundary ends up giving you an anisotropic non-relativistic field theory.
I understand,
but
there's a precise
around it,
right? You could say...
Well, you can whole story of correlation functions and...
Right.
And
So you can turn on some so what you're talking about is turning on something on the boundary. So I mean, as long as you're following the prescription that the evolution the contributions to the partition function correspond to the properties of how you evolve whatever you do on the boundary into the bulk, then the bulk is going to remain relativistic. So there's no, I mean, there's no immediate thing saying. There's no, I don't see any particular reason why you would be introducing anisotropy in the bulk.
As the chair of this session, I suggest we talk about it afterwards.
Yeah. Well,
we're happy to discuss this in detail.
Sure.
It would take us too far.
Yes.
I just, the language there suggests to me that this transformation is unique within a class. So what I'm wondering is that obviously true? Is it easy to show? So what I'm thinking of maybe is you've got two metrics that are related by one anisotropic transformation. You got one of those related to another one by a different anisotropic transformation. Is that possible, or is that...
There's no problem with that at all.
So
you can just take the metric and perform some random math and then rescale it to some other random metric. So that would give you the process you just mentioned, right?
So it's not unique. I'm a little confused.
But part of the input here. I mean, in any of the situations that we're interested in looking at, part of the input is a scaling dimension. In other words, we have only one fixed concept of Weyl transformation that's going to make sense in any particular situation.
Yeah, well, that's what I was referring to. So it is unique, right, in terms of scaling dimension. You can't have different...
Well, you could consider it in principle, allow yourself to consider all sorts of different scaling dimensions. But I don't see any mathematical motivation for doing so, or physical.
Well, I don't see any physical, but I was wondering mathematically if it were...
You could look at the problem, but certainly it's not interesting in these situations. Okay, so just to look at things in a little more detail, let's look at warp ADS space, but let's relax the boundary conditions. The boundary conditions on the metric. That is to say, we do something like what is done like what Pfefferman and Graham did by examining conformal geometry conformal geometry of arbitrary conformal classes of metrics via Einstein manifold. This discussion is going to be geometrical. I'm not making any dynamical claims about this, but it does enlighten. It does make a few points clear. So basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow us to have the metric components at infinity vary with the boundary coordinates. Okay. So that's basically what the space base law boils down to. So in particular, we recover the usual space for appropriate choices of gamma UU, gamma UV, and gamma VV. So the phase space, this choice of phase space, is preserved by all diffeomorphisms of the following form. In particular, we do see more distinctly the foliation preserving structure. F is precisely a function of U. G can be a function of U or V. One thing that actually is important is that this parameter, this is sort of like the generator of bio transformations, can only be a function of U. Okay, so the boundary metric is then this gamma thing. Of course, as was mentioned before, it's not quite a metric in the usual sense. And if we look at the action of the most general vector field on the metric, then we get the following transformation rules for what we're identifying as a boundary metric. So in particular, this has precisely the same structure as mentioned before. So this non-relativistic limit of the action of diffeomorphism groups on the metric components, it just arises naturally from the geometric setup. So if we want to look specifically for boundary metrics in which diffeomorphisms induce anisotropic conformal transformations, simplest case we can look at is the background that corresponds to the warped ADS3 metrics. And so the problem we're trying to solve is to find an infinitesimal vector field X which generates an infinitesimal anisotropic biotransformation, this thing here. And the general solution to this problem is vector fields of this form. So this would be the conformal group for this particular definition of geometry. And of course, as one would expect and hope, this reproduces the asymptotic isometry. This is a projection of the asymptotic isometries of the bulk geometry onto the boundary. It looks like we're a little short on time. Okay. I guess let me just finish up with warped ADS black holes. So warped ADS has black holes, and here's the warped ADS black hole metric. And just like BTZ black holes, these black holes are locally isometric to warped ADS spins. The local isometry has the following rather ugly form. What we're interested in when we're looking at black holes is we're interested in identifying in ADS-CFT, black holes are supposed to correspond to thermal states in the CFT. In particular, they should have the same conformal boundary as the vacuum states. So in particular, any isometry which is supposed to in particular, this local isometry, which is supposed to relate the two spaces, should induce an anisotropic conformal transformation of the boundary. These transformations are not actually foliation preserving, but as one expects, if you look at the dominant behavior at infinity, then they actually are anisotropically foliation preserving. The important part is these two pieces, where U depends only on this theta parameter, and V depends both on tau and theta. The induced conformal class metrics is this thing, just applying the procedure to before. And if we rescale we use rescaled coordinates, there's no reason why we can't rescale the coordinates. One obtains a metric of this form. Okay. And this is related to the original metric by an anisotropic conformal class. So I think probably.
Okay.
thing, because in the case of conventional Penrose definition of the asymptotic infinity, we don't even know that these solutions are black holes, because you cannot check that they have event horizons in the conventional sense. Now we have the notion of asymptotic infinity that does allow you to trace whether or not this solution has an event horizon. So you can check that it's an honest black hole, and you can check that it's asymptotically it asymptotes to the vacuum ABS3 space in this anisotropic sense.
I think that any further discussion would probably take a little long. So let me summarize. Okay. So just to summarize, both Hordeaux and Lipschitz gravity theories and general relativity sometimes do require a more general concept of infinity, of conformal infinity. Of course, in the case of general relativity, it is really important that we pay attention to the actual group of symmetries, that is, the diffeomorphisms of preserved phase space. So using this and using anisotropic biotransformations, we have a fairly uniform procedure for extracting the geometric properties of the boundary. And it provides a consistent framework in which we can extract, again, sensible geometric information from warp ABS3, Schrödinger space, Lipschitz space, etc. This is
useful for performing holographic normalization carefully, extracting stress tensor in ABS3, etc. And the last point I skipped. So I think I will end there.
The original idea of Lipschitz gravity was to cure gravity in the ultraviolet. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, completely different game, because now you say I have the theory in the bulk, and I know anyway I mentioned that my boundary theory is a fundamental theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the bulk is emerging from that. But then the question is, I have a conformal field theory on the boundary. I don't know much about that, but what's wrong with the conformal field theory, actually? Because now you modify the conformal field theory on the boundary, but this is not to cure any ultraviolet problem of the fundamental theory, right? This is just, I was wondering.
Right, so this is simply that aspect of it is simply an application of these ideas to propose duals. Now, of course, in order to really define these things properly, if you want to define it from the gravity side, you still have the problem of defining it as a consistent quantum theory of gravity. So this doesn't solve, or maybe I'm not addressing this question.
No, in some sense, I think there was never a problem. If you accept the correspondence, I'm not mentioning
that. The logic here is that the fundamental theory that you really care about here is the CFD, and the pioneers of this field, like Subir, is here in the audience. They are interested in non-relativistic CFTs that are strongly coupled. A very difficult system to analyze, unless you have some duality. And now string theory and ABS CFT is providing a potential duality using quantum gravity to understand these interesting non-relativistic CFTs. So you really insist that the theory be non-relativistic, because that's what you care about for some quantum matter application. That's the logic.
Can any of these ideas be used to have a meaningful holography in plane wave backgrounds? The conformal infinity is like just two-dimensional.
Right. Well,
I'm sure you've thought about this.
We thought about it a little bit. As far as I understand the situation, in that case, there are good reasons. There are good reasons to believe that the field theory actually does live on some smaller dimensional space. In which case, there isn't any particular need to modify the proposal. The important thing here was to give you sensible results in a case where the Penrose definition is losing geometry for you.
But view the other way, that the field theory is actually a four-dimensional theory, just a large R-charge sector.
It's a very good question. We've thought about it a little bit. We don't have any conclusive results. It's definitely worth looking into.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to, for example, now define what it means to have a black hole.
in a PP way, right, which is another, right. another issue people were struggling notoriously with because they didn't have a good sense of the notion of an event horizon.
Yes.
Yeah. So is the following one way to describe the results? So non-relativistic Newtonian mechanics has a space-time description with a degenerate metric and a vector field. And is the question, are there four-dimensional solutions of the Einstein equations, maybe with the negative cosmological constant, that have a conformal boundary, which is one of these Newtonian non-relativistic spacetimes, rather than the standard Minkowski spacetimes? Is that the
statement? I wouldn't necessarily even look at some non-relativistic gravity theory.
No. But my understanding is that you're trying to understand why it is that you can get critical behavior for non-relativistic theories holographically as the boundary of the solution of the Einstein equations, which is relativistic. So if I understand right, the statement, what you're trying to construct are space-times, which are solutions of Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant, which have a boundary after a Penrose scaling, or are conformal to a space-time with a boundary, which is a non-relativistic space-time, that is a space-time which has a degenerate metric,
okay.
just in the spatial domain. Is that the correct statement of what you've found?
It's roughly correct. I would say that you don't want that there is more, generically speaking, more geometric structure than simply a geometric metric. So in particular, generically speaking, you are going. Well, I guess the vector field does provide this. That's correct in. In particular case of anyways, but fundamentally speaking, that's correct. Yeah.
I mean, what I was looking for. I mean, you several times in a kind of tantalizing way said the structure on the boundary is not really a metric. But there's probably a precise way to say that in which it's precisely the degenerate metric which describes Newtonian.
Sometimes. Not always.
There are various options, but generically they are what you want to call the non-relativistic conformal structure. So it's all classes of metrics after rescaling. Because just like in Penrose's definition, you don't get a metric in the boundary, you get a conformal structure. Because you are still defined up to negation information.
Okay. So the conformal classes of these degenerate metrics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There is some geometric data.
Well, okay. There's geometric data that's not necessarily.
If the pi is infinite, then your metric is degenerate. Because G00 is either 0 or infinite.
The metric is degenerate. Yes. Yeah. So you have some other geometric data that represent the analog, the metric.
Right. So that particular component of the metric still carries geometric data in the generic situation that I'm discussing.
Good. I think it does just, in what's called, quote, Newtonian.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
In view of the time, unless there are some really pressing questions, I would hold any other discussion of this for the session after conference ends. And before I introduce the next speaker, I want to take this opportunity to make some personal remarks. I want to thank a few people, and in particular, I want to thank the organizers, the real organizers, who are Dario and Rob, for making this possible. It's has been an amazing meeting for me. And in particular, I want to thank the entire Perimeter Institute, because without this institution, I don't think any such meeting would even be possible. So this place plays a unique role in the quantum gravity community. I want to thank all the people who showed up, all the speakers, all the participants for this very stimulating meeting. So that's just my personal thanks for everything. And the next speaker is Xavier from Unison Hero. He's going to talk about whatever his